This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Thinking Man Films' Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy, a new documentary seeking evidence that Moses wrote the first books of the Bible. Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy, in theaters March 14th, 16th, and 19th only.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Welcome, everybody. This is a terrible question. What would you think if your grandma told you that when she dies, she wants her body to be composted or liquefied? Should we really consider human remains to be nothing more than waste material? Well, in Washington state, some are thinking that way. The Washington State Senate recently passed a human composting bill, giving people the chance to become soil when they die. And they say it's just as spiritual as other options and even more environmentally friendly than cremation. Well, I call it horrifying. We're going to get the details now from attorney, author, and bioethicist Wesley J. Smith, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism and a great writer over at National Review Online. Wesley, it's a new horror with you. Every time I have you on this show, I swear, what the heck? This is horrible. I don't even know what to say about this.
Now you know why I'm so much fun at parties.
Yeah, I'm sure. Absolutely. What in the world is going on in Washington?
Well, it's in Washington, and then also let's look at Florida. In Washington, they're passing a bill that would allow, instead of one to be buried or cremated, one to be basically composted and turned into dirt. And then the dirt, I suppose, is given to your family or your loved ones, and they can put it in a flower pot and plant a petunia in you or something of that sort.
Oh, man.
Meanwhile, Washington and Florida will also be allowing liquefaction, and it's called alkaline hydrolysis. And this is where actually bodies are dissolved into a liquid state and poured into the sewer.
Oh, my word.
Which is and the reason I wrote about this is I think that these practices, it's not so much what happens to the dead bodies as much as that I think these practices reflect a growing belief in anti-human exceptionalism, that all we are is an animal in the forest, and that it doesn't matter whether we were here because we're just carbon that thinks, you know, that's animated. And once the animation ceases, well, then, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, sewer to sewer, compost to compost.
Oh, man.
It's a disturbing trend, not one that should necessarily be outlawed, but certainly one that I think we should think about very seriously, because it also denies us our connection not only to the past, but to the future.
True.
You know, when people visit graves of loved ones, that's an important thing. When you and I, perhaps, you know, I'm very fascinated by old graveyards. I now live in Old Town Alexandria. And, you know, I pass Christ Church and I see some of the old tombstones, and I think about the people that lived here 200 years ago.
Yes.
And I think that when we're gone, hopefully, that we were here will have mattered as well in some fashion.
Of course.
So these things just cause me some disquiet.
Oh, yeah. And you really nailed the reason why it's so distressing, and that is it is an attack on human exceptionalism. If you're no better than whatever can be composted, then what was your life in the first place? I'm wondering why they want to compost people. Where did this idea even come from? Because we have burial, we have cremation. Why did it go to composting all of a sudden?
In a sense, it's also an earth religion where the idea is that we have to be green. Well, for me, the greenest type of funeral arrangement would be what Orthodox Christians, I'm an Eastern Orthodox Christian, you know, we're buried in a wood box without embalming.
Right.
That's pretty green.
Yeah, it is. It is.
You know, and also, of course, in Christianity, the body matters. Because the human essence is both body and soul, not just soul,
right?
And certainly not just body. But I think what this is a, you know, it's a kind of a fashionable statement on the environment. But I also think that it is a disdain for human beings. There's a great deal of misanthropy in the air, Janet. There's a great deal of anti-humanism that is reflected beyond, of course, this is just a symptom. The idea for example, Lake Erie was just voted to have rights in Toledo. And this whole idea of nature rights, which means that nature, which is, of course, Lake Erie is a geological feature, but it is being elevated to an equal sense of moral worth to human beings. The animal rights movement tries to do that with animals. The Amazon has been declared a person. There's an orangutan in Argentina was given a writ of habeas corpus out of a zoo as a non-human person. So there is a great deal of emotional anger and effort to tear down human beings as the apex of creation and turn us into just another animal in the forest, as I said. And I think it's a very almost neurotic approach to looking at life.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I, not to get too gross about this, but I am curious about this composting of human beings, how it even works. What do you do to a dead body then in order to compost this body? What is the process for that?
I didn't go into the detail on that, but it's called recomposition. And they're placed in a vessel and put under great pressure. And once that is completed, all that's left is dirt.
Oh, a vessel. What kind of a vessel? Like a pressurized, you know?
I'm assuming, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, which is also how the liquefaction works.
That's horrible. That's isn't that desecrating a corpse?
One would think. I mean, you know, when you think about a dead body, we still respect dead bodies even though they're gone.
Yeah.
For example, the example I use in the piece in National Review is if somebody is dead on the street, we will cover their face, right?
Right.
Not that they can understand that their privacy is being interfered with, but we know that that was until recently a living human being, and we respect that living human being. We treat human remains with great respect. And one of the great science fiction movies of all time, I think, was Soylent Green. And it showed the consequences of eventually, you know, having such little respect for the sanctity of human life that, as you know, at the end of that movie, we find out that Soylent Green, which is being used as a food for an overcrowded population, is made from dead human bodies.
Yeah.
And it was considered, and there's even a euthanasia scene in that movie. Edward G. Robinson goes to a euthanasia center. This was in the 70s, and I remember seeing it as a young man, and it was shocking, the idea that you would go to a center to be killed. And now, of course, that's exactly where we're heading, and that's exactly what is happening in some states and in some countries. And it's a very disturbing thing, because the less we think of human beings, the more it reflects not only on how we treat each other as in life, how we think of ourselves in juxtaposition to animals and nature, but also how we treat people who have passed away.
Right. Well, wouldn't this also be consistent with the Darwinian worldview, where you believe that if your life doesn't really mean anything, there's no God, you weren't created, you're not going to heaven or hell when you die, you're just going to go into the earth. So what does it matter how you're disposed of? But there's not a discussion about, well, what are you losing in the process when you treat human beings as if they're just ants or insects?
That's right. You know, you don't have to have a theistic view to understand that human beings have a unique place in nature, that we are the most exceptional species that ever existed. Whether or not that was as a result of creation, or whether it was a result of forces of evolution that had no intention, whatever happened, intelligent design, as my colleagues at the Discovery Institute discuss, whatever reason, we are something quite special. You know, we're the only species that ever looked at a sunset with awe. You've had life on this earth for a long, long time. And just as an example, the dinosaurs, they never looked at each other with awe. Have you ever been in O'Hare Airport?
A lot.
And seen that big dinosaur?
Oh, a lot.
You know, look at it and you go, holy cow.
Yeah.
But the dinosaurs, when that thing was walking the earth, they weren't looking at it and thinking, holy cow. They were thinking, oh boy, maybe that's dinner.
Yeah, right.
Or they were thinking, I better stay out of its way so it doesn't step on me. Only human beings have this understanding of something that transcends. Only we are capable of awe. Only we are capable of moral thinking and moral value.
That's right. We're going to come back. Wesley J. Smith with us. We'll talk more about what's going on in Washington and this human composting bill. Stay with us. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today.
From Thinking Man Films and Fathom Events comes Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy. A new documentary follows investigative filmmaker Timothy Mahoney's faith-affirming journey throughout the Middle East in search of scientific evidence that Moses wrote the first books of the Bible.
The Lord said to Moses, write this in a book.
Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy. In theaters March 14th, 16th, and 19th only. More information is available at patternsofevidence.com/Moses.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Roadside Attractions presents Run the Race. Two brothers share an unbreakable bond, but life's unexpected adversities put their future in question.
It's all part of his plan, right?
God does love you. He loves you like crazy.
From executive producers Tim Tebow and Robbie Tebow, Run the Race. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. Now play. More information is available at runtheracemovie.com.
We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you with us, and great to have with us Wesley J. Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism and writer at National Review Online. We are talking about this human composting bill. It has passed the Washington State Senate, I guess now moving on. Very green state, very liberal state. But what happens when human remains become nothing more than waste material? You're losing a lot more than just your old funeral process or your cremation process. You're losing fundamentally regard for human life. I have a question too on this, Wesley, because when we talk about the liquefaction, this is just so gross, but I think people need to hear about this. If Washington permits remains to be liquefied, this alkaline hydrolysis that you mentioned, as I understand it, they would become the 17th state to allow this. So this is That's news, correct, to me. I didn't realize you could do this. You could liquefy. Can you talk a little bit and explain why you would do this, why you would want to liquefy a human body, and why we have so many states that allow this?
You know, it's a term I've heard called anonymous death, which my friend Joseph Bottom wrote about a while ago. And it basically is that the idea is that once you're dead, what difference does it matter whether you were even here? And you're basically abandoned without ceremony. And in some cases, it might be an unmarked grave. Of course, that's a Muslim practice. But certainly in this situation, what they do is they turn you to liquid and they literally pour you into the sewer.
Yikes.
Now, if that isn't a symbolic statement of what you think the intrinsic worth of human beings is, being poured into a sewer along with everything else that gets poured into a sewer, then there's nothing else that one can say. Yeah. And people are being sold this because, oh, this means I'm environmentally friendly and so forth. There are ways that you can dispose of remains that are more respectful of human life and its importance, and still, you know, environmentally friendly without that. Again, I'm not saying it should be outlawed, but I am saying that when people think this is a good way to go, they ought to seriously ponder why they would want to be ultimately part of sewage.
I don't get that, because then what do? You go through the sewage treatment plant after that and get recycled?
Apparently.
I mean, what one would think so.
Yeah. Ugh. Apparently.
Oh, you know what? I think you should outlaw that. Maybe you're a little bit more, you know, I know you're more informed on this, but that's gross. I don't want people going down into the sewer. That's disgusting.
Well, you know, the government is there to make sure that when we our remains have their final disposition, that it's done in a way that is healthy. And this would not cause any ill health, physical health. I do think it's terribly nihilistic.
Yeah, it is. Well, what about when you quote Joseph Bottom, which I know you did in your piece, in an essay that he wrote at First Things. I thought this was a very interesting observation, that the modern failure of funerals serves as both a cause and a symptom of the shattering of culture, first into the nuclear family, then into atomized individuals, and at last into nothingness, referring to what you referenced before, the anonymous death. What is your opinion about the modern failure of funerals as contributing to this problem and reducing this idea of human exceptionalism?
Yeah, I quoted, and Joseph, Jody as I call him, is a very good friend of mine. He's the one who started me thinking about this question when he wrote that particular essay. You know, I'm an Eastern Orthodox Christian. And for us, a funeral matters because it isn't just about the life that one led, but it's also about the hope of eternal life that, one's faith would help one attain, right?
Right, right.
So we've gone from funerals to kind of life celebrations. And one of the things that bothers me about modern life is if somebody, even if it's the most tragic thing, well, we have to get on to the healing. And my response is, no, we have to go through with our grieving.
Yes.
Because grieving is an expression of love.
Yes, it is.
Grieving is an expression that this person's life here mattered. Grieving is an expression of our loss, that even if we have great, you know, faith that, the person will have eternal life, they're not here in the now with us.
Exactly.
And so we've moved away from the idea of focusing not only on the life that one lived, but also the hope that we have for that person, and grief. It's like we're not allowed to have grief anymore.
Yeah.
To you know, well, we're just going to have a life celebration. I'm not against celebrating somebody's life, but it's not like that's all that's involved in life and death.
Right.
So that's just me, and I'm not, again, if people feel that's best for them, then that's best for them. But Jody hit something here. We're moving on a continuum. So now, you know, the issue of death, you know, it's almost like, well, death isn't, you know, we'll just pretend that didn't happen, to these kinds of anonymous dispositions where your body or your ashes aren't even present if people hold a memorial service.
Yes.
If there's a memorial service held. And there are a lot of people who just want, when I'm gone, I don't want to even have any memorial service. I don't want a funeral. I want it to be as if I wasn't here. And I find that puzzling. Some people find it meaningful. Again, this isn't about what should be the law or not, but I do think it is a reflection on how we view human life and its importance or lack thereof.
I agree. You are hitting every cylinder with me, because I think exactly the same way. I think that we have not done the right thing as we move more into the idea that we need to celebrate someone's life immediately after that person dies and not go through that mourning process and the grief process and being able to have a funeral. Because that is, I think, a ceremony that is important for the living to be able to process the loss of a human being, which is important.
And going to visit a grave.
Yes.
You know, that is, there's a, there in Mexico, they have the Dia de los Muertos, which is a little bit much for me, but people gather at cemeteries to remember and consider their loved ones. In many Christian practices, you know, you have remembrances of people after they're gone. But I just find myself worried that the expression of lack of concern once one is gone is going to morph into a lack of concern for people who are here.
Yes.
And here's the problem, and this lack of grieving, for example. We have to heal, we have to heal. Well, obviously you don't want morbid grief, but grief is a natural process, and it is an expression of love. We're moving society away from the purpose of society to protect the intrinsic dignity of human life, to protect the life of the innocent. Society is now being pushed to the primary purpose is to prevent suffering. And so anything that causes discomfort, anything that causes suffering, even if it's the sufferer, we're trying to eliminate. So, you know, you have euthanasia on one hand. Well, we're going to eliminate suffering by eliminating the sufferer. But you're also having this idea of, well, we can't have any concept of death and whether there's a consequence to how we live, because that's something else that gets into this.
Yeah.
If you believe that how you live will impact what happens after death, you're going to have one approach to these issues. If you think you're just carbon molecules, all you are is a carrot with a brain, then you're going to have another concept of how to deal with these issues. And I can't think of anything darker than raw materialism, where you think that there really is nothing of intrinsic meaning. Everything is just carbon atoms or other kinds of atoms flowing around and maybe gathering in a particular form and then dissipating. That's a life without meaning or purpose.
Very true. Well, and what came into my mind was, I'm sure you saw this, you've seen everything along the euthanasia and assisted suicide lines, but there was that news story that was done in California where I think it was an MS patient. She decided she was going to have physician assisted suicide, and she threw a party, and all of her friends and family came, and they filmed it, and it was beautiful lighting and a nice sunset, and oh, she's going to kill herself tomorrow. And I thought, every single one of these people are complicit. They should be talking her out of this. And instead, they're being forced to, quote unquote, celebrate the end of her life. This is sick and twisted.
Suicide parties. I don't know if you've had a chance to read my book, Forced Exit, but I got into this because a friend of mine, this kind of human exceptionalism work, and I started by fighting assisted suicide and euthanasia. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine killed herself under the influence of Hemlock Society literature, and they taught her that it was empowering to kill yourself. They gave her moral permission to do it, and they taught her how to do it. And meanwhile, she was a depressed woman. She killed herself on her 76th birthday. Her friends were trying to keep her in life. And about a year before she did it, she tried to hold a suicide party where she told her friends, I want you to come and gather. You tell me how much you love me. I'll tell you what you mean to me. And then I'm going to kill myself. And we all said, are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And we held an intervention, and we made sure she got some assistance, and she got out of that suicidal binge. Now that kind of thing is being celebrated in the mainstream media as somehow empowering, because they're trying to normalize the idea that when life gets difficult, then you kill yourself.
Right.
Instead of caring for each other.
That's true. I mean,
so you're going
exactly.
to kill yourself, and then you're going to be poured into a sewer? Is that where we're heading?
I know. Do you think Washington will go all the way with us? It sounds like there's nothing necessarily stopping them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, once you've accepted the premise, why not?
Yeah, I guess. Well, and this is the thing, and I think everything that you cover, you do such great work, Wesley, because you really follow these trends bit by bit by bit so you can see where things are going. But we need to know about this, because if people are not informed about what's going on in states like Washington, then we don't know enough to be able to fight it and to call up lawmakers and say, what, are you crazy? You can't do this. And I certainly hope that even if Washington does pass this, people are going to fight it if it goes to other states. Wesley J. Smith, always an honor to have you here, Wesley. Thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you, Janet, very much.
All right, God bless, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today, and congratulations to Christian Baker Jack Phillips of Colorado. This poor man, everything he's been through, as Alliance Defending Freedom puts it, 6 years, one U.S. Supreme Court ruling, and a second lawsuit later, the state of Colorado has finally stopped its hostility toward cake artist Jack Phillips and his faith. What's been going on? Well, you'll recall back in June of 2018, Jack Phillips won his case at the Supreme Court. It stems back to 2012, I believe it was, when he was first brought up on charges, a complaint that was filed by two homosexual men who wanted a wedding cake from him. And he said, I'm not trying to be mean. I'll be happy to serve you, but I can't make a wedding cake for two men here. Why don't you go to this other bakery? They'll accommodate you. And that set in motion this legal crusade against Jack Phillips. And finally, in June of 2018, he won his case because the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had openly expressed religious hostility toward Jack Phillips and his Christian faith. And also the commission had declined to force bakeries involving homosexuals to bake anti-homosexual cakes or pro-biblical cakes. So, I mean, obviously they were taking sides. Obviously they had a clear point of view. They weren't evenly applying the law based on what the law was. They were playing favorites. And if you were pro-LGBT, then you got what you wanted. And if you were a Christian, then there was religious hostility. So this case went on. And as soon as that whole thing was over, all of a sudden, Jack is hit with this request for a gender transition cake. Actually, that particular request came a lot earlier than people even realized. But I want to go back to a CBN report from December. This kind of outlines what went on at the time. Listen to cut three.
For Jack, the state agency acting against Phillips lost here at the U.S. Supreme Court, with justices specifically blasting it for hostility toward Phillips' religious beliefs. Now the Colorado Civil Rights Commission is going after the Christian baker again, this time for refusing a transgender celebration cake.
At this point, they're just targeting Christians. This is outright Christian persecution.
This time around, though, constitutional attorney Jenna Ellis believes the commission will be more subtle.
The masterpiece decision was very particular to the commission to say you cannot be overtly hostile. So now what they're doing is they're just going to say, well, we won't be as obvious about our hostility, but we still want to go after Jack.
Meanwhile, Phillips and his lawyers are going on offense by suing the Colorado bureaucrats.
They are actually striking back and saying, this is just outright persecution. You're not interested in stopping discrimination. You're interested in hunting Christians down.
If Christians are always only on the defensive, then we're going to continue to lose ground eventually. We have to be also making sure that we're standing up and we're standing forward.
Well, that's right. They also talked about why the case should concern all Christians, this case that now has been dropped, but at the time was very concerning and really ought to continue to concern Christians because the hostility is not going away, even though Jack got a break finally. But listen to what they had to say back in December. This is cut four.
Ellis and Hunt warned people of faith should be deeply concerned about their religious freedom, given some of today's leaders and officials.
Even after the Colorado Civil Rights Commission heard from the U.S. Supreme Court in a 7-2 decision, including Obama appointees telling them to stop targeting people of faith, the government essentially ignored it.
This is about whether or not the government can compel you or me to say something and to embrace and celebrate messages that go against our sincerely held religious beliefs.
Jack Phillips is very much a canary in the coal mine with regards to the very legal issues, very important legal issues that we're going to be facing.
So why care about this one baker and his little masterpiece cake shop in a suburb of Denver? Because if you hold certain beliefs and you're a Christian, you could be the next Jack Phillips.
That's really the truth. More than people realize. You could be the next Jack Phillips. That's why it was so important that Jack stood up and went to the mat to defend his rights. Because when he was going to the mat to defend his rights, what he was really doing was standing up for our rights as well. So I'm so appreciative of what he has done and the stand he was willing to take, because that man has been through the ringer. In fact, at the time the second case was filed, this is what Jack had to say. This is cut one.
Yeah, it is surprising. It all started the day that the United States Supreme Court announced that it was taking our case back in June of 2017. That very day, an attorney here in Colorado called me up and asked if we could create a cake to celebrate sexual gender transition and pink and blue cake. it's a cake that we couldn't do, couldn't create the cake because of its message, but we tried to make it clear that we could sell this individual anything else in our shop or other custom work, but we couldn't create that one because of my babe.
All right. And his attorney talked a little bit more at the time about the timing of the second case, which Jack alluded to right there. But this is, it just shows how sleazy the entire thing was. This is cut two.
The request came on the exact day that the Supreme Court announced it was going to hear the previous case. And then a complaint was filed soon thereafter. And then the Colorado Commission sat on it for over a year until less than approximately 3 weeks after the Supreme Court issued its decision in Jack's case, in which it found that this very same state commission and these very same state officials were hostile to his faith, they decided to double down on that and to come after him again by pursuing him in this other complaint regarding this request that Jack described for the cake celebrating a gender transition.
Fine people, aren't they, on the Colorado Civil Rights Commission? It's absolutely incredible. And this is why it was good that Jack filed suit and he was willing to, you know, go against them legally. And good for him. Good for him. And now that I guess they've reached this truce and he's not going to file. But David French had an interesting piece over at National Review. I really like the headline on this. As new evidence of progressive bigotry emerges, Jack Phillips finally wins his case. And he references the 7-2 decision at the Supreme Court rebuking the Colorado Civil Rights Commission for its clear anti-religious bias. And it had pursued new charges, as we know, against Jack for failing to design this gender transition cake. He adds this, though. Remarkably, the evidence showed that Colorado had actually doubled down on the religious bigotry that caused it to lose at the Supreme Court. Justice Kennedy singled out this statement from Commissioner Diane Rice. Now, you'll remember this, but let me quote it. I would also like to reiterate what we said in the hearing or the last meeting. Freedom of religion and religion has been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history, whether it be slavery, whether it be the Holocaust, whether it be, we can list hundreds of situations where freedom of religion has been used to justify discrimination. And to me, it is one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use to use their religion to hurt others. Yes, she really did compare Jack Phillips to Hitler. At least it seems that way, if you're going to cite the Holocaust. Absolutely ridiculous. How in the world is it the same thing to bring together the Third Reich to eliminate Jewish people from the face of the earth, and that's somehow analogous to a Christian saying, yeah, I really don't want to bake a wedding cake for two men. Yeah, that's exactly the same thing, Diane Rice. This is what Justice Kennedy said in response. Quote, to describe a man's faith as one of the most despicable pieces of rhetoric that people can use is to disparage his religion in at least two distinct ways, by describing it as despicable and also by characterizing it as merely rhetorical, something insubstantial and even insincere. This sentiment is inappropriate for a commission charged with the solemn responsibility of fair and neutral enforcement of Colorado's anti-discrimination law, a law that protects discrimination on the basis of religion as well as sexual orientation. And yet David French says, despite this clear language from the court, Colorado officials continue to express the same sentiments. Two commissioners actually endorsed Rice's unlawful comments after the Supreme Court issued its ruling. It was at the June 22nd, 2018 public meeting. Members of the commission discussed this ruling. And during that discussion, Commissioner Rita Lewis said, I support Commissioner Diane Rice and her comments. I don't think she said anything wrong. Later, Commissioner Carol Fabrizio added, I also very much stand behind Commissioner Rice's statements. I was actually proud of what she said, and I agree with her. I'm almost glad that something the commissioner said ended up public and used because I think it was the right thing. Okay, these people have no business serving in public office. Go. If you don't understand the concept of religious freedom and the First Amendment, you don't have any business in public office. These people should never see a public office seat ever again. It's ridiculous. And the amount of anti-religious hostility, we can't put up with it, cannot put up with it against any Christian in the United States in this kind of situation. So happy for Jack Phillips, but continue to pray for our country that we will continue to see the tide turning back in favor of religious freedom. We're going to take a break and we'll come back on Janet Mefford Today.
Hi, this is Kirk Cameron, and I am honored to be partnering with the Ministry of Preborn to help moms choose life.
Actor Kirk Cameron supports Preborn.
My four oldest children were adopted. That is because of caring and compassionate people who help those young mothers choose life. My wife is an adopted child, and her birth mother chose life for her. If it weren't for those caring individuals that help those young moms value the sacredness of life, I wouldn't have my wife, I wouldn't have my four adopted children, and the two natural-born children that we have wouldn't exist either. My whole family is here because of people that are involved with ministries like Preborn.
Preborn funds pregnancy centers across the nation so they can offer free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. Ultrasound is a game changer because when abortion-minded women actually see their babies in their wombs for themselves, 80% of the time, they choose life. Would you please join us at Janet Mefford today to support the Ministry of Preborn? For $140, you can provide 5 free ultrasounds to women in crisis pregnancies. A gift of $22 will provide 1 ultrasound, and every gift helps. To donate, please call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes directly towards saving babies. Think of the children in the womb this January. You can get involved, and you can help save a life for a gift of $140. 5 free ultrasounds will be offered to women in crisis pregnancies. Please call now with your gift, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. On Janet Mefford today. Well, members of the House have now offered their version of a Medicare for All bill, and it is so radical that even some of the most radical senators are beginning to drift away from it. This bill also comes as a new analysis by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has debunked one of the Democrats' key figures in shutting down the repeal of Obamacare. We're going to get some thoughts on it all now from Dr. Merrill Matthews, resident scholar with the Institute for Policy Innovation. Dr. Matthews, great to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing well, Janet. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. What do you make of this bill that's been put forward now? What, about 100 Democratic co-sponsors so far? And this is pretty radical, all right.
Yeah, about 107 was the last figure I saw. So it's a large number. Bernie Sanders has a large number of Democratic senators on his bill in the Senate. And this one is considered a little more, the House version, a little stricter in the sense that Bernie Sanders would transition over to a full government-run health care system in 4 years after passage. The new House bill takes only 2 years. We're going to do that in a hurry. And they provide some long-term care for people in nursing homes and other things in it. And ominously, the House bill does not mention any way it's going to pay for this legislation that they've got. But they don't want to have any co-pays, no deductibles. Health care becomes free in almost all cases under both pieces of legislation.
Wow. So what everybody...
Let me revise that. Free at the point of use. It's going to cost taxpayers a lot of money.
Good clarification, because nothing is free. No, it's true. It's true. And you go back to 2009 and the debate over Obamacare and how people were saying even back then, oh, come on, we know what Ezekiel Emanuel is about. We know what these crafters of Obamacare are about. This is just an incremental step towards single payer. Here we are. Is anybody apologizing now for having lied about it 10 years ago?
Not at all. In fact, we have tape of Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, and Harry Reid all saying that they preferred a single-payer system. And even to your point of some moderate Democrats pushing back, I think for the most part, the moderate Democrats who are pushing back aren't pushing back against the idea. They're just not sure the country may be quite ready for that yet. They feel like maybe moving over to a single-payer system may hurt them at this point. But I think what will happen is that the Democratic convention coming up in 2020 will nominate a person. It'll be part of the Democratic convention platform. They want to go to Medicare for All. And actually, that's a euphemism, because both these legislation eliminate Medicare as it exists now. They create from scratch a completely new government-run healthcare system, and I think that would be part of the Democratic platform, and I suspect that the Democratic presidential nominee will be a supporter of that.
Well, right, because you look at some of the senators who are now kind of backing away from this. They include presidential hopefuls Klobuchar, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren. I mean, that's not by accident that you have these far leftists who are saying, oh, no, I'm not sure about this. Even Cory Booker. I mean, are we really supposed to believe Cory Booker doesn't think this is a great idea? Doesn't pass the smell test.
Cory Booker was at the Bernie Sanders introduced his legislation last year, Cory Booker was standing there beside him, as was Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
So they were there then. If they feel like that may be a bit of a political liability now, it's only a recent awareness on their part.
Yeah, that's right. So talk a little bit about this idea that even people like Kamala Harris have said is a great idea, which is to get rid of private health insurance. Private insurers then, under this bill, as I understand it, wouldn't be allowed to sell plans that compete with a government program. So everybody is forced onto single payer, whether they like it or not, that you can't even pay, for example, for a doctor with cash. Is that basically what this bill is doing?
Yes, but to be clear, that's already the case in Medicare right now, the program for seniors. If you're a senior on Medicare and you go to a doctor and you say, you know, I'd like to do this, but, you know, for whatever reason, let's say you're visiting a psychiatrist and you'd rather just not have that on the medical record for some reason. You can't pay the psychiatrist cash if Medicare pays for it. You cannot do it. If the doctor says, well, look, I'm charged $100 for this, Medicare only pays me $50, so I can't do the service for you, you can't pay the difference. That's called balanced billing. It's against the law. So that's already the case right now. So to some extent, seniors who are on Medicare are already under this kind of control, but they've generally negotiated it fairly well. But what both the House and Senate version would be completely eliminate private health insurance, except for if there's any gaps in the legislation. And that means for your listeners, if you get your health insurance through your employer, that's gone. If you work for Amazon, you work for Google, Facebook, Apple, you get really great health insurance from those companies. If you work for an energy company and they provide really good health insurance, you can kiss that stuff goodbye under this legislation.
Well, do you think some of these insurance companies that got on board with Obamacare 10 years ago are now kicking themselves for having done that? Because they'll be out of business if this thing passes.
Well, I think they probably feel that they saw their stocks rise significantly over the first 3 or 4 years of that. I mean, in some cases, quadrupling and quintupling in their stock prices. So this was always going to be the case. When I talked to them back around 2009, 2010, I talked to some of the executives of insurance companies. These people had no clue as to what was actually going to happen on this because you could tell this was a step to going to single-payer system. Now, there can be a fair debate as to whether or not Democrats thought Obamacare would work before they went to the single-payer system. I think a lot of them thought it would. Others said, no. They knew that wasn't going to work, and they were just using this as a way to create to destroy the system. Either way, they're moving quickly on this. And here's the great irony here, Janet. I mean, you just can't get over this. They passed Obamacare with Democrats only, claiming this will lower premiums, create access, better coverage. It's all going to work great. That has not happened. None of those claims have come true. And now they're saying, yeah, we destroyed the health insurance market for you, but trust us to get it right this time as we create a government-run system.
Yeah, right. It's crazy. Well, and when we talk about CMS, this is very interesting. I had mentioned this at the outset. The Democrats had been claiming that Obamacare's a repeal would result in 14 million Americans losing their health coverage in the first year and something like 25 million over 10 years, something like that. Now CMS has come out and said only an additional 2.5 million Americans will be uninsured in 2019 as a result of the elimination of the individual mandate penalty. And virtually all of those people have chosen to go uninsured. So they lied about that. Now you've also got the administrator, Seema Verma from CMS, who has previously criticized the Medicare for All proposals being proffered by these liberals, calling the idea last year's scariest Halloween costume and referring to it as a socialistic idea, which it absolutely is. So will there be much traction from this new analysis from CMS, do you think?
I doubt there's much, because I think most Democrats, even if they sort of give lip service to the notion of we want to fix Obamacare and make that better, they all want to move on to the government-run health care system. That's their sights right now. So that's they don't want to just stand up and say we want to abandon Obamacare, but that's essentially what their plan is, I believe.
How is this constitutional? We have the 10th Amendment saying the powers that are not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states, respectively, the principle of federalism. How does the federal government in a free country have the right to circumvent and take over the healthcare system in total?
Well, because number one, the federal government is allowed to tax. That's what Chief Justice John Roberts used to provide the fifth vote to allow the government to move forward and Obamacare to move forward. But because you have a Medicare system in which we tax people during their working days and the government pays for health care for them in their retirement years, you could argue that we've already got this in a small portion, and this is just an attempt to try to move to something much bigger. I would agree with you. It's not clear to me that the Constitution allows that, but we haven't been able to stop the current Medicare system or the Medicaid system. So we may have a struggle with the Supreme Court again if this ever gets passed.
Yeah, I agree with you, because people, it's one thing where people said, all right, Obamacare, give people the option, going on the exchanges, that sort of thing. But here, you take away private insurance, you're taking away people's freedom, flat out.
You absolutely are. You've got 170, 180 million people who get health insurance through their employer, dependents and workers who get it through the employer. So it's a huge portion of the country. And I think a lot of people will be, some of those health insurance policies out there from employers aren't the greatest, but a lot of them are very good, and people don't want to lose that. And one of the reasons why in Obamacare they actually sort of left employer-based health insurance alone is because they knew they'd lose that argument if they were coming in and adjusting that.
Well, good information. We've got to leave it there, but thank you so much, Dr. Merrill Matthews, for being with us, and check him out at ipi.org. This hour of Janet Mefford Today brought to you by Thinking Man Films' Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy, a new documentary seeking evidence that Moses wrote the first books of the Bible. Patterns of Evidence, The Moses Controversy, in theaters March 14th, 16th, and 19th only. Thanks so much for being with us on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time.